From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter has written a new book on the Middle East with a very controversial title, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. In the book, he describes Israel as practicing a policy of apartheid in the West Bank and Gaza. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Carter about his book and about the new ceasefire in Gaza. Perhaps Carter's greatest achievement as president was negotiating peace between Egypt and Israel. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The View from Castle Rock, the latest short story collection by Alice Munro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, former President Jimmy Carter, has written a new book about the obstacles to peace in the Middle East and what can be done to overcome those obstacles. The book is controversial, and the title helps explain why. It's called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. As we'll discuss in a moment, Carter describes Israel as practicing a policy of apartheid, depriving Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank of their basic human rights. Perhaps Carter's greatest achievement as president was negotiating the Camp David Accords, which created peace between Israel and Egypt. Yet almost three decades later, there is still not peace in the Middle East. There's been some forward movement in the past couple of days. Yesterday, Israeli troops pulled out of Gaza following a Palestinian ceasefire. Today, Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said he was prepared to make concessions if Palestinians are serious about peace and willing to renew talks. President Carter, welcome back to Fresh Air. What's your reaction to the ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, first of all, it's long overdue, and I think it's very promising for Israel to withdraw from Gaza for the second time and for the Palestinians, all factions of them, to agree to forego any further firing of rockets into Israel, I think is a major step in the right direction. And it's the first indication in a number of months of any inclination on the part of both sides at the same time to agree on something that's important.
What would a good next step be?
Well, we haven't had any, even one day of substantive peace talks between Israel and any of her neighbors in the last 6 years. And my hope is that this will be give a glimmer of hope for the Israelis and the Palestinians to sit down and talk to each other under the sponsorship of either the United States or the so-called International Quartet, which includes, as you know, the United States and Russia and the United Nations and the European Union. So some kind of peace talks are long overdue. I think this is the first time since Israel has been a nation that no effort has been made for this long to bring the two disputing parties together.
You suggest that the United States could help bring the parties together and help in negotiations. Do you think the United States still has that same kind of standing as a broker for peace that it did a few years ago? Do you think that between the war in Iraq and the United States' reluctance to push for a ceasefire immediately after the hostilities began between Israel and Hezbollah over the summer, that its position has been compromised?
Yes, its position has been compromised. There's no doubt about that, because in the past, even, I'd say particularly during the time of George Bush Sr., there was a general feeling, I think it was accurate, that the United States was taking a fairly objective point of view between Israel and the Palestinians. That is no longer the case under George Bush Jr., when we have acquiesced or looked the other way and almost always approved whatever Israel chose to do. And so it's long overdue. And I think that's the most important impediment to the United States being acceptable, even more so than our invasion of Iraq. If the United States is not an adequate mediator or convener of peace talks, then I would prefer to see the International Quartet, which includes the United States, as I just said, also includes Russia and the United Nations and the European Union. That might be a better and more objective forum to orchestrate some kind of new effort toward peace talks.
Ehud Olmert has said that he would be willing to have talks with the Palestinians if the Palestinians give up the right to return and recognize Israel. Would you approve of those two preconditions? Do you think that there should be preconditions to talks?
No Palestinian leader could survive a week who gave up the right of return, which is guaranteed under United Nations Resolution 194 and has been one of the prime bases for any sort of reconciliation in the Middle East. There could be some nuances of it. That is, the right of return would apply just to the West Bank and Gaza, and with Israel having a veto over anybody who came back into Israel. That has been worked out with a proposal under the Geneva Accords. But so far, neither Olmert nor his predecessor, Sharon, has been willing to negotiate at all with the Palestinians, even though their choice and the choice of the United States, that is Mahmoud Abbas, was a prime minister under Arafat for 3 years and was later elected to be president. And he was characterized by the United States and others as the moderate voice of the Palestinians. But even when he was ordained as the one to represent the Palestinians, still not a single day of negotiations has been permitted by Israel or the United States.
Well, it's very problematic right now for Israel to negotiate with the Palestinians since Hamas heads the government.
Well, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, the prime minister, who is a member of Hamas, Haniyeh, has said that he strongly supports direct talks between Olmert and Abbas, representing Israel and the Palestinians, and that if an agreement is reached with that negotiation and approved by the Palestinian people, then Hamas will accept it. But until an effort's made, there's no way to ascertain if this is a good faith commitment or not.
Yeah, but if Hamas doesn't even recognize Israel, where do you go with that?
Well, when I asked that same question to Hamas, urging them to recognize Israel, they said, which Israel are you asking us to recognize? Are you asking us to recognize Israel that's occupying the West Bank? Are you asking us to recognize the Israel that is occupying East Jerusalem? We don't know which Israel you're talking about. As a matter of fact, the Arab world, as represented by the Arab League, 23 nations, came together in 2002 and adopted a proposal made by then Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, he's now the king, that prescribed the full recognition of Israel to live in peace among all its neighbors within its recognized borders. And this was approved unanimously by the Arab League. So I think that the overwhelming sense of commitment in the Arab world is to recognize Israel, provided Israel would withdraw from occupied territories, as is required by the United Nations resolutions, by the U.S. government official position, by the commitment that Israeli leaders and their parliament have made at the Camp David Accords in 1978-79, and again in the Oslo Agreement, sponsored by Norway, for which all of these Israeli leaders received, by the way, the Nobel Peace Prize, and is also approved by a majority of the Israelis, that is, to exchange peace for Israel for the relinquishing of confiscated land that belongs to the Palestinians.
Now, you know what you just said before about the head of the Hamas government having said, well, which Israel should we recognize? Is it the Israel of the pre-1967 borders? Is it the Israel that, you know, has the West Bank and the Gaza as occupied territories? Isn't that kind of like an evasive answer? I mean, couldn't they say, well, we recognize Israel's right to exist, but we don't recognize Israel's right to be in the West Bank and the Gaza? Isn't there a way of recognizing Israel's right to exist without ceding the larger territorial Israel?
Yes, I think there is a way to do it, and I wish that all the Palestinians would do this. As you probably know, back in the early 1990s, in 1993, as a matter of fact, when Arafat went to Oslo and negotiated an agreement with the Israelis, at that time, the PLO had not recognized Israel's right to exist. And as a result of the Oslo Agreement, Arafat did come back. He did recognize Israel's right to exist. And the PLO official position is that Israel does have a right to exist. As a matter of fact, the only Palestinian organization that is recognized by Israel, or the United States, by the way, is the PLO. And the PLO is headed by Mahmoud Abbas, who is very eager to negotiate on behalf of the Palestinians and conclude an agreement with Israel. But obviously, I wish that all Arabs would just say unequivocally, as the Arab League has said in 2002, that we recognize Israel's right to exist and live in peace, provided Israel with, will withdraw to their recognized international borders. That would be my preference, obviously.
Yeah, but how do you negotiate with people who won't even recognize your right to exist? Where do you start there?
Well, there's no need for Israel to negotiate with Hamas. Israel doesn't recognize a government within which Hamas is playing any official role. The only organization that Israel recognizes that represents the Palestinians is a Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. That's the only Palestinian organization that's recognized by the United Nations as well. And Mahmoud Abbas is the only leader of the PLO. So if Israel wants to negotiate a peace agreement, then they don't have to acknowledge the presence of Hamas. They just have to recognize the PLO, which they do recognize, and negotiate with Abbas.
And you think that Hamas would abide by such an agreement?
The only thing I know is what the Hamas leaders have said, that they would abide by such an agreement if it's approved by the Palestinian people. And that is the premise that I negotiated personally in 1978 between the Israelis and the Egyptians. And it was approved by the Israeli parliament. That is, that any agreement that was reached between Israel and the Palestinians would be submitted to the Palestinians for approval, so that you couldn't have just a few leaders get inside a closed room and negotiate. The Palestinian people themselves would have to approve. As a matter of fact, the most recent poll that was done by the Harry Truman Institute in one of the universities in Israel has shown that 77% of all the Palestinian people do approve a two-state solution and do approve negotiations between Mahmoud Abbas, the head of PLO, and the Israeli leader, Prime Minister Olmert.
My guest is Jimmy Carter. His new book is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, let's talk about your book, and let's start with the title. The title is already getting you in trouble with a lot of people. The title is Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. That's a very provocative title. Why not call it something neutral like The Never-Ending Middle East Crisis, What Each Side Needs to Do? Did you want to be deliberately provocative with this title?
Well, you know, when you write your book about the Middle East, you can name
it. Yeah, I'm working on it now.
Well, I made it plain with two words in that title that it shouldn't be provocative. One is the title Palestine, and that does not include the nation of Israel. It includes the West Bank and Gaza. Secondly, I said peace, not apartheid. I'm not advocating apartheid. But I am recognizing that within the occupied territories, there is an element of apartheid, not based on racism, as I make plain in the book, but based on the desire of a minority of Israelis to confiscate Palestinian land. And in this confiscation of land and the colonization of property deep within the West Bank, there has been developed a system of apartness, I call it apartheid, that in many ways is more oppressive than was apartheid in South Africa. The land of the Palestinian people has been confiscated. It's been occupied and colonized illegally by Israelis. More than 200 settlements in the West Bank. Those settlements have been joined with each other and with Jerusalem by highways. The highways are prohibited to be used by Palestinians. In fact, there is a law that's going into effect in January that makes it illegal for any Palestinian to ride in an automobile that has an Israeli license plate on it. At the same time, a horrendous wall is being built rapidly deep within the West Bank, deep within Palestinian land, that ultimately is designed completely to encapsulate or to imprison the remaining Palestinians on the remnant of their own land. And the ends of the wall will reach at the north and south of the West Bank to the Jordan River Valley, which is completely controlled by the Israelis. At the same time, Gaza, which is about 30 miles separated from the West Bank by Israel, is completely enclosed in a high wall, and there are only two doors in that wall that are open. One is open into Israel, which is mostly closed, and the other door is opened into Egypt's Sinai, and it's closed most of the time by Israeli forces. And no goods can travel from Gaza into Egypt's Sinai. Only people can go who have a special pass. So in effect, the walls around Gaza and the wall that's being built around what's left of the West Bank are imprisonment walls. They couldn't be a worse case of apartness or apartheid anywhere in the world.
Are you afraid that by using the word apartheid in the title that you lose a lot of Israelis and Israel's supporters just in the title? I'll read you a couple of quotes here. Nancy Pelosi says, in reaction to the title, "It's wrong to suggest that the Jewish people would support a government in Israel or anywhere else that institutionalizes ethnically based oppression, and Democrats reject that allegation vigorously." John Conyers says the use of the term apartheid in the title, quote, "does not serve the cause of peace, and the use of it against the Jewish people in particular, who have been victims of the worst kind of discrimination, discrimination resulting in death, is offensive and wrong." So are you concerned that even though you think Israel's practices are a practice of apartness, that by using the word apartheid, you risk alienating just the people who you want to convince?
Well, I would like to convince Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers, but what I wanted to do is to express a fact that is almost completely avoided and not expressed in the United States, but is well known in other parts of the world. And let me repeat, I am not referring to the nation of Israel. I did not include that in the title at all. I'm just referring to Palestine, which is the area outside of Israel in the West Bank and Gaza, that in which Israelis are practicing apartheid. Within Israel, they are not doing that. So that's a distinction that should be drawn. And I realized when I chose this title that it would be provocative. I hope it provokes people to actually read the book and to find out the facts, none of which have been disputed, about what is going on in Palestine, in the Palestinian territory, not what's going on inside the legally constituted boundaries of Israel.
Alan Dershowitz, the lawyer, wrote an op-ed about your book, and he calls your book one-sided. He said that you don't explain, quote, that Israel's motivation for holding on to land it captured in a defensive war is the prevention of terrorism. Israel has tried on several occasions to exchange land for peace, and what it got instead was terrorism, rockets, and kidnappings launched from the returned land. So what's your reaction to Dershowitz's criticism that the book is one-sided? You're not criticizing the Palestinians, and you're not explaining that Israel's policies are reactions to terrorism.
Well, there's no doubt that there have been terrible acts of violence by the Palestinians and also by the Israelis. I give the actual statistics about the number of people who were killed in the so-called times of violence, the first intifada and the second intifada, as a matter of fact. There have been about four times as many Palestinians killed, almost seven times as many Palestinian children killed as Israeli children killed. Any deaths are deplorable, and my hope is that we can have a peace agreement so that these deaths will not continue. Another thing I've heard Professor Dershowitz mentioned is the holding of the Israeli soldier captured by Palestinians by digging a tunnel under the wall to escape from Gaza, where they captured an Israeli soldier. And that's true. I wish that the Palestinians would release this soldier. At the same time, Israel is holding about 9,000 Palestinian prisoners, including 300 children, some of them 12 years old, and about 100 women. And as soon as the Palestinians captured the Israeli soldier, they offered to swap the soldier to Israel for the release of some of the women and children. Israel has refused to consider this kind of swap. So it's a terrible situation, and I hope that it can be corrected, and I hope that my book, with a provocative title, to use your word, will encourage people just to find out what's going on. And I might say, to repeat myself, that a substantial majority of Israeli citizens have always favored the exchange of Palestinian territory for peace. It's a minority of Israelis that are violating international law and are perpetrating this persecution of Palestinians.
Jimmy Carter will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. And from BMW, creating innovative Valvetronic technology designed to deliver power with minimum fuel. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jimmy Carter reflects on his efforts as president to broker peace in the Middle East. His new book is called Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new short story collection by Alice Munro. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former President Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book about the obstacles to peace in the Middle East and how to overcome them. It's a controversial book with a controversial title, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It accuses the Israelis of practicing a policy of apartheid in Gaza and the West Bank. Your book seems to really be asking Americans to examine how Israel has conducted itself in terms of its policy toward the Palestinians and its willingness or lack of willingness to negotiate. And let me read a quote from your book that I think will probably be pretty controversial, too. And you write, there are constant and vehement political and media debates in Israel concerning its policies in the West Bank. But because of powerful political, economic, and religious forces in the U.S., the Israeli government decisions are rarely questioned or condemned. Voices for Jerusalem dominate in our media, and most American citizens are unaware of circumstances in the occupied territories.
That's exactly right. That's exactly correct. And I think if you would just read the U.S. media and watch the television and listen to the radio, you would rarely see any voice of strenuous opposition to Israeli policies in the Palestinian territories. However, when I go to Israel, which I have done often, and with the Carter Center election observers all over the West Bank and Gaza and much of Israel, there are intense debates that go on in Haaretz, the newspaper, and the Jerusalem Post on television and radio in Israel. None of those debates of a detectable nature have existed in the United States. I think it's time for us to look at both sides of this issue.
But you were saying that there are powerful political, economic, and religious forces in America that make it difficult to question Israeli policy. Did those voices that you're describing, that you say exist in the United States, did they interfere at all in your negotiations on the Middle East?
No, they didn't, because I basically ignored them and went directly to the route that was within my purview, using the power and influence of the White House to bring the two primary antagonists together. And I would say the proof was in the pudding. You know, it took me a long time. After Sadat did agree to recognize Israel, to open up the Suez Canal, Israel agreed to withdraw from the Sinai Desert. As you know, Sadat was, Egypt was isolated by the Arab side, and eventually Sadat was assassinated. Later, when Rabin and Peres went to Oslo and met with Arafat and negotiated the Oslo agreements, the aftermath of that was that Rabin was assassinated by a radical Jew in Israel who said he wanted to stop the peace process. So there have been a lot of powerful forces that have opposed courageous steps toward peace. But the overwhelming majority of Israelis and all their neighbors want peace. And I think that it's time in this country for the television, radio, newspapers, even members of the House and Senate, to acknowledge that the key issues should be addressed. But at this time, and in the last number of years, there has not been any substantive discussions of the facts that are included in my book. And for the last 6 years, as I've said, there has been no effort at all by the United States to orchestrate peace talks.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Now, you write in the book, none of the options for peace are attractive for all Israelis. You describe Israelis' current policy as a system of apartheid with two people occupying the same land but separated, with Israel dominating and suppressing violence by depriving Palestinians of their basic human rights. You don't like that as an option. Here's the other two options you see. One is forcible annexation of Palestine and its legal absorption into Israel, but that would give Palestinians the right to vote in Israeli elections, which basically means it wouldn't be a Jewish state very long. It's the third option that you think is the best and the right option, and that is, as you describe it, withdrawal to the 1967 border as specified in the UN Resolution 242 and as promised in Camp David in Oslo and prescribed in the Roadmap for Peace. And you say this is not only the most attractive option, it's the only one that can ultimately be acceptable as a basis for peace. And a lot of people would say in answer to that, well, easier said than done. If Israel pulls out of the West Bank and Gaza and a Palestinian state is formed there, in spite of whatever promises are made, Israel may have armed enemies on their borders firing rockets, sending in suicide bombers, and initiating acts of war. How can Israel be assured that if there is peace talks, if Israel completely withdraws from the territories, that they will actually not be threatened across the borders?
Well, there's one caveat that I put in that third option that you didn't mention. That is that the borders of 1967 can be modified by good faith talks, that is, land swaps, swapping land on the West Bank to Israel, which could include, under the optimum premises, maybe half of the total Israeli settlers who are living in the West Bank, let them stay there. In return for that, Israel would swap to the Palestinians an equivalent amount of land either east of Gaza or a few places inside the current nation of Israel. So with good faith talks, there could be an accommodation approved overwhelmingly by the Palestinians and the Israelis that I think would be the best premise for peace. Obviously, no one could guarantee that there wouldn't be isolated instances of violence in the future. But with the entire Arab world already having expressed its approval for such an agreement, and with it having been negotiated, as I described in one of the chapters in the book called the Geneva Agreement, I think this accommodation is the best chance, and it would have an overwhelming offering of permanent peace for the Israeli people.
My impression from the book is that there's parts of the Camp David Agreement that you think Israel has failed to follow. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct.
What are they? And I'm wondering, too, how that affects your reaction to Israel, if you are, like, personally disappointed in Israel because you negotiated these peace talks and you think Israel hasn't completely complied with them.
Well, at Camp David, Menachem Begin, Prime Minister of Israel, agreed to withdraw the political and military forces of Israel from the occupied territories. And the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, approved this commitment. Menachem Begin also signed the Camp David Accords, which includes specifically United Nations Resolution 242. And one of the phrases in there confirms the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force and also requires Israel to withdraw from occupied territories. Those commitments, freely made by Prime Minister Begin and approved by the Israeli government at the time, have not been honored. And instead, the Israelis have continued to occupy additional Palestinian land and then to, in effect, confiscate it and then to colonize it and then to connect those isolated more than 200 settlements with each other and with Jerusalem, all providing obstacles to any sort of peace process unless Israel would withdraw from those territories. So in a number of ways, Israel has defaulted on the Camp David Accords. The one major thing, however, that Israel did that's very gratifying to me was to honor the commitment to withdraw from Egyptian territory. Israel was occupying, as you know, the Sinai region all the way up to the Suez Canal. Israel did indeed withdraw from that territory within 2 years after the peace treaty was consummated.
So do you feel like personally frustrated with Israel because you think they haven't followed Camp David?
Well, I would personally obviously prefer that both sides complied with the agreement that I helped negotiate, yes. And I am frustrated with Israel that they haven't done so. But to be repetitive on your program, I hope you don't mind, this action by the Israelis to violate the agreement is a minority of Israelis consistently. Down through the decades, public opinion polls have shown that a majority of Israeli citizens themselves favor the withdrawal from Palestinian territory in exchange for peace. It's a minority that has violated that, and this minority has come into power overwhelmingly after the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin. And so far they are prevailing.
My guest is Jimmy Carter. His new book about the Middle East is called Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jimmy Carter. We're talking about his new book, which is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Now, you say in your book that private discussions with Arab leaders are much more promising than their public statements would lead one to believe. Could you give us some examples of that?
Yes. For instance, when I was negotiating between Begin and Sadat back in the late 70s, privately, I had the full support of the Jordanians, King Hussein, and the full support of the King and Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia for what I was doing. In fact, when I concluded the peace treaty in April of 79, and I took off in Air Force One from Jerusalem, having reached an agreement finally, the first message I got was from the King of Saudi Arabia, congratulating me on this momentous step toward peace. A few days later, Saudi Arabia joined in and ultimately became the leader of the Arab nations that condemned Egypt. They withdrew the Arab League headquarters from Cairo, and they tried to organize an embargo politically and economically against Egypt because Sadat had done this horrendous thing. So that's just one example.
You know, the Bush administration pushed for democratic elections in the Middle East. And in the Palestinian, in West Bank and Gaza, that brought Hamas to power. And in Lebanon, it brought Hezbollah to power. These are two groups that won't recognize Israel. And these are also two groups the United States officially considers to be terrorist groups. Now, you oversaw the Palestinian elections. You certified them. The Carter Center certified them. And so after Hamas won the majority of seats in parliament in these elections that you oversaw and certified, Israel and the United States wouldn't recognize the government and withdrew funding as punishment to them. What was your reaction after certifying the election, saying it was fair, and then having the United States and Israel not recognize the results?
Well, let me add very quickly that the European Union had a much larger delegation there than the Carter Center did. And the National Democratic Institute was there as a partner with us. There was unanimity among every international observer that the elections were honest, fair, and safe, and accurately represented the will of the Palestinian people who were permitted by Israel to vote. And so when then the United States and Israel decided to punish all of the Palestinian people because they had voted for Hamas candidates, I came back home to Plains, Georgia, took a shower, got back on the plane, and flew to London, where the International Quartet was meeting. And they gave me 12 minutes on the program, which was long enough for me to say that it was unfair to punish the entire Palestinian population because of the way they had voted. Mahmoud Abbas, with whom I met immediately after the election, told me then that because of Israel's policies, that the Palestinians were bankrupt. That was in January. He said that they couldn't meet their payroll for February without continued assistance. There was an agreement reached after the Oslo compact that Israel would collect customs duties and tariffs for the Palestinians and turn that money over to the Palestinians. That's Palestinian money. It amounts to about $55 to $60 million a month. Beginning immediately after the election, Israel is withholding all of that money from the Palestinians. So the Palestinians have not been able to pay their policemen, their firemen, their school teachers, their welfare workers, their nurses, anybody that's on the Palestinian payroll since that time. And this has created horrendous suffering among the Palestinian people. It's been particularly onerous and abusive in Gaza, which is a tiny territory surrounded by a high wall, because Israel has also cut off food and supplies going into Gaza and has not permitted the Gaza people to sell the produce that they produce in hothouses and so forth outside. So the United Nations High Commissioner on Food has stated that within Gaza, that their degree of starvation has approached the poorest African countries south of the Sahara Desert. And this High Commissioner on Food also reported that over half of the people in Gaza are now subsisting on just one meal per day.
You know, in preparing for this interview, I was thinking that the two biggest things that happened during your presidency, your biggest achievement and your biggest nightmare, were both, in a way, the start of something new that is still with us today. Your biggest achievement, the Camp David peace accords, and we're still negotiating Middle East peace. The biggest crisis that you faced, the Iranian hostage crisis, and you could argue that that was the beginning of the United States coming to terms with radical Islamism, which we are still dealing with today. So when you look back at your presidency, do you see those two things as being like enormous turning points in the world?
After the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah Khomeini became the leader, we quickly established a relationship with the so-called revolutionary government. We had a very harmonious relationship with Iranian diplomats in Washington, and obviously we had our diplomats in Iran. They were the ones that were later taken, but that was after the Shah was overthrown. When we finally concluded the negotiations with Iran and the hostages were returned, I was expecting that we would soon have basically normal relationships with Iran again. That has not occurred. And I think that the upcoming recommendations by Lee Hamilton and James Baker, one of the basic premises of it will be that the United States ought to open up diplomatic relations with Iran and also Syria.
And it looks like that is what they're recommending based on advanced leaks or discussions of it.
And it's just a matter of logic, yes.
Yeah. We spent most of this interview talking about the Middle East. Your new book, Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid, is about the Middle East. Is the Middle East the most difficult subject to talk about without getting one side or both sides absolutely furious with you?
Well, I think so, but you have to realize that a lot of other wars that go on that don't get much publicity over here. The Carter Center has just completed helping to monitor the election in the Republic of Congo, where 4 million people have been killed in the last 10 years or so. And that election might be successful. We just completed, since then, the election in Nicaragua. That was the 67th Democratic election in which I and the Carter Center have been involved. And we earlier did the one, two of them in Indonesia that brought democracy for the first time to that fourth largest nation in the world and by far the largest Muslim country. So there are conflicts that go on around the world that are much more costly in lives than in the Middle East. But I think you're absolutely right that this is the most contentious issue because the feelings are so intense on both sides. And they permeate outside the Holy Land into surrounding and even more distant parts of the world.
Well, President Carter, very good to talk with you again. Thank you very much for talking with us.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it again.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Alice Munro's new book of short stories. This is Fresh Air. Short story master Alice Munro would be justified in resting on her laurels at this point in her career. She's won Canada's Governor General's Literary Award 3 times and the National Book Critics Circle Award. But in her new collection of short stories, called The View from Castle Rock, Munro veers off into a fresh direction, exploring family history through fact and fiction. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I'm sure Alice Munro, as usual, was just trying to weigh her words carefully at the outset of her new short story collection, The View from Castle Rock. But her preface does read a bit like a warning label designed to enlighten by now suspicious literary consumers as to the ratio of fact to fiction contained within the 12 stories that follow. Munro says that the stories in the first half of her book were inspired by old letters and journals concerning her family history in Scotland and Canada. These stories, Munro claims, are as truthful as our notion of the past can ever be. The more contemporary first-person stories in the second half of the book are not memoirs exactly, although she says they pay more attention to the truth of a life than fiction usually does, but not enough to swear on. I'm still confused about what generic label to affix to these stories, but I'm not at all confused about what to call them. Haunting, wise, spare, deeply sad, just plain magnificent. To the extent that many of Munro's stories here are autobiographical, she reminds jaded readers that oftentimes the most daring secrets an autobiographical piece of writing can reveal are not the over-the-top confessions about sex, drugs, and recovery, but rather those small but devastating betrayals of thought and affection known only to the person who harbors them. For instance, towards the end of the collection, there's a story called The Ticket, in which Munro recalls herself as a clever, restless young woman. This Munro is eager to exit the life of manual labor that her family, who supported themselves by fox farming and factory work, had trimmed themselves to. Munro's fiancé in the story is a young man from more comfortable circumstances. She has this epiphany to offer about her family's teasing. I knew what they thought about Michael. They thought he was too brightly smiling, too nicely shaved and shiny-shoed, too well brought up and heartily polite. They had a habit of poor people, perhaps especially of poor people burdened with more intelligence than their status gets them credit for, a habit or necessity of turning their betters, or those whom they suspect of thinking themselves their betters, into such caricatures. Those hesitations you hear in Munro's sentences, that relentless casting about for just the right word, would be annoying if she were a lesser writer who never quite nailed it. But she does, time and again. In a compact phrase that speaks volumes, Munro, through her fictional alter ego, dubs her father a man of kind evasions. And that's in a story called Home, in which she's describing his final illness. Munro doesn't shy away from issuing equally chilly judgments about herself, or to be more precise, about the first-person narrators who stand in for herself in these stories. In the same story, Home, her narrator says she narrowly missed becoming one of those rural misfits, captives, nearly useless, celibate, rusting. She adds, I can see myself as a middle-aged daughter who did her duty, stayed at home, thinking that someday her chance would come until she woke up and knew it wouldn't. This is stern stuff. But in light of the family history that Monroe partly pieces together and partly invents in the first half of this collection, you can see that strain of flint running through her Scottish ancestors. These were people who farmed in the Ettrick Valley of Scotland, a land described in an 18th century source Monroe quotes as having no advantages. Monroe brings that ancestral world, or a drizzly gray facsimile of it, to life. It's a place where Presbyterian elders roam the landscape on the lookout for fornicators, and those with the strength to move pack up their damp bedding, lock the farmhouse door, and book passage on boats to North America. As Monroe makes clear, she's descended from people who are always suspicious of words because they didn't have much use for them in the course of a workday. When I was growing up, her narrator says in the penultimate story called What Do You Want to Know For?, an appetite for impractical knowledge of any kind did not get encouragement. It was necessary to learn to read, but not in the least desirable to end up with your nose in a book. Fortunately, Monroe is a genetic maverick whose taciturn inheritance shows in her choice of the short story as her signature form and in the scrupulously chosen words that make those stories breathe.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The View from Castle Rock, a new short story collection by Alice Monroe. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology. Capella.edu. From Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Why is it that for some young women today, empowerment means taking their bathing suit tops off on camera for Girls Gone Wild? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Aria Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.